able to make the best of life. But at the end of the day, it also tells us that, look, you can make all these decisions. At the end of the day, it's going to be what God wants, which is the best thing for you always, because He loves you more than anything in the world. And also, know that all these decisions that you make have these set and constant results and consequences. If I live my life, if I make the choice of seeing the good in life, knowing that God wants what's good for me, if I live my life making the choice of bettering myself, keeping strong, powering through, grinding through the years, looking forward to the brighter horizons that are ahead of me, that's obviously what I'm going to find. That is going to be the consequences of my actions and my decisions. But if I sit around on my hands, staring at the wall, doing nothing, leaving it all to fate, I will most probably die of hunger. There's no other outcome. And that is the beautiful balance that we have to establish for ourselves in life. And that's what makes life simple yet complicated, because it has this general rule of the universe as it was created, but then each individual is a universe in and within themselves as well. As Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam says, you think you're small, but you forget that you are a compact, folded MP3 version of the universe. Obviously, Amir al-Mu'mineen did not use the term MP3, but you get the idea. That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa Al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program, Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, most of the answers are based upon the holy book of the Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today, dear Sayyid, we will be talking about how some parents unfortunately tend to lie to their children out of a vast array of reasons. But this may have negative consequences for the upbringing of their children. Dear Sayyid, please tell us why we shouldn't lie to our children.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in al-rajim, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salam ala Muhammadin wa alihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin. Now, with lying itself, it is definitely a vice. Uh-huh. It's not a deed, right?
Of course, it's a sin.
It's a sin, and it's one of the major sins. It's a big sin, so even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala looks at it really, you know, in a negative scope. And to emphasize on how bad lying is, a person came to the Prophet, he says, does a believer commit adultery? He said to him, yes. He said, does a believer drink? The Prophet says, yes. Does the believer do this? Like, yes. Does a believer lie? He said, no.
To that extent.
So even one of the Imams, I can't remember, I think it was Imam Hassan Askari, he said everything, all the bad vices are locked in a safe and the key to it is lying. So when you lie and it becomes a habit, right, you can commit any sin. But sometimes, for example, even with adultery and drinking alcohol, you could commit it one time.
Right.
And you can repent from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, repent to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, ask for forgiveness and it's over.
Because it stems from
it's just
sinful
one. It's
lust.
Just a sin for itself.
Right.
But lying is a door to so many things. If you lie about this today, you'll lie about that tomorrow, and then that chain of lies will continue.
It escalates.
Until you commit so many sins just because you had the key to them all, which is lying.
One lie. Right.
So we have to be very careful not to pass on that method to our kids. Now, you can say, well, yeah, I'm a truthful person, but my kids lie. Well, I say, well, then obviously there's something else that caused them to lie. For example, so either if you're not, so some parents to begin with, they lie in front of their kids themselves, right? They lie and they kind of think of it as a white lie because, you know, apparently we have a white lie and a black lie. Yeah,
right.
So someone knocks on your door, or someone calls on the phone, and you tell your child to pick up and tell them that dad is not here. I'm not here, right?
Simple example, but
Yeah. Oh, for example, that, you know, someone invites you over, like you pass by someone or you are at someone's house, they give you something, and like you're hungry. Which I'm like, well, I'm not hungry. And then just once you get like, oh, I'm so hungry. So you indicate to your child that you lied.
Right.
So sometimes you lie in front of them, either deliberate lying or deliberate lying.
Right, and on that note, dear Sayyid, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing why parents should never lie to their children. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Now, so we said when it comes to lying, either you lie to them directly,
right,
or either you lie in front of them, right?
Right.
So they see that you're doing a lie.
Same result in the end.
With the same result. Or sometimes you make a liar out after them. So, for example, two siblings, they get into a fight, and you weren't there, so they come to you, and he says, he hit me. She says, no, he hit me, right? Now, who is the truthful one? So sometimes you might have an idea, you say, like, oh, no, I believe him. You might take a side, for example, make a letter out of a child, one of them. Right. Or sometimes he does something, and he breaks a glass, and he says, it's not me, right? I look, no, I know it's you. I know it's you. So what you're doing is you're making a liar out of him. So we say, okay, that's not required. That's not needed. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't make a liar out of him, because if he thinks that, okay, dad doesn't believe me now. And then, like, I've heard this from kids so many times, like, no matter what I tell my parents, they never believe me.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying they are saints. I'm not saying they don't make mistakes. They don't, you know, trying to get away with things. They do.
Of course, yeah.
But they do not. The parents don't make it easy for the kids, because sometimes the parents themselves, they see so many lies from their kids, right? Like, I'm not going to believe him anymore. So whatever he says, it becomes like, you're lying, you're a liar. He's like, okay, I'm a liar. Like, he adopts that personality without realizing. Subconsciously, he becomes a liar.
So, dear Sayyid, what should one do in the aforementioned situation where the child obviously does something wrong, like breaking a glass, and then lies about it? How should you go on about the situation?
Okay, so this is the case. Why does a child need to lie about something?
Right.
Okay, so obviously he lies about it. Either he's afraid that the consequences would be severe, either he's, he thinks he will lose something. So either loss, either fear, or either other reasons that he has seen from his parents when such an event takes place. For example, right. He's seen his mother drop a glass, the father yells at her or calls her names. Now, that's registered in his head. That happens to him, and he automatically calculates that if I tell dad, I'm going to get the same treatment.
Right.
So there's always, it begins as a concept of fear. But for example, if the parents don't care what happens, right? For example, my father, he's have that system. He's like, you know what? Tell me the truth, I'll let you go. I won't do that. He's like, you can do the biggest crime in the world. If you tell me the truth, I will not touch you.
That's a good way to encourage honesty and truth.
Yeah. Right. So if you have this kind of system where the kids can tell you whatever, now with my same thing with my kids. Like my kids could do the worst things, and they tell me, like, okay, I don't care. Big deal. Like, you broke something, you destroyed them. Then what? I can replace it. Not a big deal.
Right.
So they have no chance. They have no reason to lie.
Right. Now, and fear you.
Yeah. So they have no kind of. So they have. There's no fear involved. So they can explain to you, tell you what you want. So if you make a liar out of them, obviously that's going to be a problem.
Right.
And sometimes we force them to lie. And also that's a problem.
Dear say, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, and today we are talking about why you shouldn't at all lie to your children. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
So sometimes I said we force the child to lie.
Right.
Now, a situation has happened, right? And you know it has happened yourself. And you ask the child if he'd done such an action. Now, you know, and he knows that you know.
Right.
And now he knows you're trying to put him in a trap.
Right.
You're trying to make a point. You're trying to make a point. Right. Now, in his own understanding, the only way to get away with it is to lie.
Right. That's the only way to escape punishment.
Yeah. Oh, for example, he comes from school. The school, they give you a call before he arrives.
Right.
Like, okay, your son today, he got really bad marks. He got D's and C's in his exams and in his work. You already know this information. And they say to you, we gave the result to the son to give to you. Now, he knew that he can't show you the result because he's going to cop it.
Right.
So he hides that paper from you, and he's hoping that you're going to forget.
Right.
And he now you already know, right? Right. Yeah. He comes home, and he thinks you have no idea.
Yeah, of course. Right.
And you say to him, oh, so how? What's your result? How was the result?
Right.
Did you get a paper? So you basically, all you're doing is now you know.
Right. You're fishing
forcing him. You're right. Literally forcing him to lie, because obviously we have this this defense mechanism.
Right.
We call it fight or flight.
Right.
Right? And children, right. Obviously, they're going to fly.
Of course.
So,
right.
So it's
right.
A defense mechanism. So you kind of force them to lie.
But aren't you also forcing your child, perhaps some people may think, to own up to their mistakes by making them admit that they got, for example, bad grades?
No, so that's what I'm saying. So from the beginning, if my child has, if he understands that nothing is going to happen to him if he tells me the truth,
right.
If he's truthful with me, then he wouldn't need to lie. And if I don't go throughout, you know, these
right,
sneaky
okay.
ways to
true.
Get to my child, if I'm just straightforward, he would have no reason to lie. For example, my son, when he comes, for example, from school, and he brings his marks, sometimes some of the topics, he's really bad at them. He just doesn't care. He just gives me the paper. There you go. You know? He knows
right.
There's nothing I can do about it. And right. He knows I'm not the angry type. I'm not going to get angry at him. I'm not the right. Hitting type. So he's a safe. You know, he's like,
right.
Okay, that's what I have. I'm like, Habibi, why is like, why, you know, you got so much bad in this particular subject? He's like, okay,
right.
Dad, well, you know, I did not study. It was a bit hard, this and that. So, you know, so it's cool. So he doesn't need to lie.
Right.
But if one time he would have came to me and I would have slapped him or yelled at him or punished him, he would never show me his marks.
Right.
Or he would be very scared. Or he's trying to delay. He's like, oh, tomorrow. They did not give it to us.
So that there should be a balance. You shouldn't intimidate them, but you also shouldn't be too lenient with them.
Now,
obviously,
we always say the balance has to be maintained. But when we
right.
talk about lying specifically, a parent has to be very sensitive to what he does, whether
right.
lying to them, lying in front of them, or forcing them to lie. Right?
Right.
That these things he tries to avoid as much as
so
he
can. So
that's
more important than being lenient. Or
Yeah.
It's
got nothing to do with being lenient.
Right, right. Dear Saeed, we will unfortunately have to end today's program. I thank you for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any questions, comments, or just some feedback, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. We also have social media accounts on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Take care.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Communique. Last week, the seventh round of talks began in Vienna. Over the weekend, the various parties went home for consultations, and now they've returned. This has been the second week of negotiations for Iran to try and get the U.S. back into the deal that Donald Trump tore up in 2018 and to end the maximum pressure campaign that Biden has continued in his place. As I mentioned last time, Vienna is packed with luxury hotels, very fancy hotels, and every participant in these talks is staying at a different one. I'm standing in front of the Intercontinental, where the Iranian delegation is staying. Meanwhile, the talks are taking place just over there at the Palais Kobour. Now, last week, I spoke with Professor Merendi, who's advising the Iranian delegation. This week, I sat down with Dr. Baghari, Iran's chief negotiator. He's tasked with representing Iran at these talks and forging the best possible outcome for Iran's interests. That means getting the United States to respect the deal they signed together in 2015 and to lift all sanctions. I asked him how the talks were progressing, about Iran's recent draft proposals, threats and intimidation by Israel, and whether Iran could trust the Americans not to break the deal again if they actually go back in. Dr. Baghari, first of all, welcome to Vienna, and thank you for taking the time to sit down and do this interview with me. The first question I wanted to ask you is, you have now resumed the seventh round of nuclear negotiations, talks to get sanctions lifted. This is the first time you're leading this delegation under the new Raisi government. What are you doing differently compared to your predecessors who were here 5 months ago?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
What we are emphasizing in this round of negotiations, and what has been already emphasized by the President of the Islamic Republic of Iran and other senior officials, is that in the Vienna talks, our main priority is to remove the illegal and cruel sanctions which have been imposed and reinstated against the Iranian nation during the past several years. The sanctions imposed and reimposed by the United States against the Iranian nation are in violation of the international law and regulations, as well as principles, and an international agreement called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, as well as the provisions of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231. In addition to Iran, other members of the group 4 plus 1 and even the new U.S. administration, they all agree and confess that the previous administration of the United States did a wrongdoing in pulling out of the JCPOA, and for this reason, the new administration, the Biden administration, wants to return from that mistake, and they want to return to the 2015 agreement.
And speaking of these unilateral sanctions that have been imposed by the United States, you've submitted two draft proposals just last week, one on sanctions removal and the other one on Iran's nuclear commitments. Has there been any progress with these draft proposals, and when can we expect to see a third? What would be in the third?
During six rounds of negotiations in Vienna in the past, ultimately the two sides drafted several texts. Two of them were about the removal of sanctions and Iran's nuclear commitment. There was presidential elections in Iran. There was a new government in power. There was a new approach, new priorities in various areas, including the foreign policy. And it was normal that the new government, the new administration, would have some observations and modifications with regard to the text drafted on the 20th of June this year. And on the basis of this, the Iranian side incorporated its observations and modifications on the sanctions removal and on the nuclear commitments into the draft documents concluded in 20th of June 2021. In one of the drafts of the 20th of June, which was on the nuclear commitments of Iran, there were numerous differences between the two parties. And the draft text of nuclear commitments included and contained a lot of brackets which indicated differences in approach between the two parties. The modifications formulated by the new Iranian team on the text on nuclear commitments were much less than the differences and issues of differences which existed in the original 20th of June document. And since the beginning of the new negotiations, as of 29th of November, various sessions and working groups were held at the experts level and senior political directors level in order to discuss both the drafts. And during the past days, there have been a lot of sessions of the Working Group on Nuclear Commitments in order to identify the differences in the draft text on nuclear commitments within the framework, within a specific framework, and in order to restrict and limit the number of differences. And on such a basis, there is still ongoing negotiations between the two sides in order to finalize the issue of differences between the two sides so that we enter into negotiations to remove those differences. And very good progress have been made, as with the meetings which had been taking place since several days ago.
The Russian ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations in Vienna is Mikhail Yulianov. He's also taking part in the Vienna talks. I interviewed him just a few months ago. Now, just earlier, he posted on Twitter that journalists were misinterpreting his comments and twisting his words. He said that, quote, many diplomats don't like to give interviews in order to be on the safe side. Probably they're right. This evening, I was in a rush for provided comments to journalists at their request. I was misinterpreted. Be aware that I assess positively, not negatively, the position of Iran. In another tweet, he said that, to my surprise, some analysts and journalists describe the situation at the Vienna talks as dramatic, almost deadlock. This is not the case in point. He also described the atmosphere of the talks as positive. Last week, when I interviewed Professor Marendi, who's advising the Iranian delegation, we spoke at length about how inundated the media is with propaganda, Orientalist rhetoric, and spin doctors trying to derail the talks, portraying Iran as uncooperative or non-compliant, dragging its feet. Now, while speaking to Dr. Baghri, I asked him as well about recent reports in the media from anonymous U.S. officials who had made negative comments about the talks. He told me that what we're dealing with are two completely different realities, that what is said outside in the Western press and what's actually happening at the negotiating table are two completely different things. He said the same parties who attacked Iran's nuclear facilities, meaning Israel, were trying to derail the talks and poison the constructive atmosphere that they've reached in the negotiating room. In terms of what was drafted in June and what's being drafted now, there are American officials, anonymous officials talking to the press who say that Iran has basically pocketed all the beneficial concessions, the things that are good for Iran, and dropped all the other things, and that Iran is buying time, trying to waste time with the negotiations. I mean, this doesn't reflect what you just told me, where there's progress being made. Where do these opinions come from? What are they based on in the Western press?
We are presently facing two atmospheres, two places. One atmosphere or space is inside the negotiating room, and one is outside. Inside the negotiating room, there are specific parties that are negotiating, and they are already clear. But outside the negotiating room, it is not clear which identities are operating and what are they doing. The same escalatory identities that targeted Iran's nuclear facilities in terrorist operations and terrorist attacks, the same escalatory identities are trying to seriously provide obstacles and create obstacles on the progress of nuclear negotiation. And in addition of trying to poison the atmosphere outside the negotiating room, they are hoping that they would be able to provide a disconstructive or non-constructive atmosphere also inside the room.
The way most people think of the Vienna talks, they think of the following parties being involved: Iran, China, Russia, the US, UK, France, Germany, and the EU. But there is an additional entity involved, an outside actor affecting the negotiations and placing its thumb on the scale, and that is undeniably Israel. It is no secret that Israel isn't a fan of the nuclear deal. It has been opposing the JCPOA from the very beginning. Whenever there have been negotiations, Israel has gone to the U.S. and attempted to derail the talks by speaking with U.S. officials and asking them to quit. And of course, we've gone over the numerous acts of assassination and sabotage that Israel has carried out against Iran over the years. Now, just in the last days, while talks are happening here in Vienna, the head of the Israeli occupation forces, Benny Gantz, is said to have drawn up plans for a military strike against Iran, that he had informed the Americans of this. I wanted to know how Israel's past aggressions and transgressions against Iran and these new threats that have surfaced during the recent days factored into the negotiations.
Speaking of these provocateurs, people who are trying to escalate the situation, Israel in the last years, they've killed Iranian nuclear scientists, they've committed acts of cyber attacks, acts of nuclear terrorism, sabotage in nuclear facilities. How is that factored into the talks? Does this even come up during the talks? Because the United States has participated with Israel on these attacks. And what's your reaction to these statements coming out in the last days that Israel is basically preparing a plan B or some kind of backup plan, which would include military action in case the talks in Vienna don't work out?
It is already crystal clear that Zionists are trying very seriously in order to have a negative, a non-constructive, and destructive atmosphere inside the negotiating room. They are pursuing the same destructive measures, as I mentioned, outside the negotiating room. And for this reason, the Zionist regime authorities are trying to spread the role of such a destructive role to the players which may have an influence inside the negotiating room. And some of these players are having some sort of contradictory behavior. On one hand, they are saying that we are negotiating in order to resurrect the deal and the United States returns to the deal. And on the other hand, they are either authoring and writing joint press opinions and articles and participate in long-hour meetings with that illegitimate entity in order to destroy the negotiations or create serious obstacles on the way of progress of negotiations. And any impediment or obstacle on the way of the progress of negotiations should be blamed on the players which provide the Zionist regime with the chance, with the opportunity, with the capacity and possibility to conduct destructive and non-constructive measures on the progress of negotiations.
Dr. Bagri, you mentioned this kind of contradictory behavior. Something that stands out is in the last week, the United States has imposed more sanctions on Iran while there are talks ongoing to lift sanctions on Iran. The Biden administration said it would rejoin the JCPOA. Biden's been president for almost a year. That's still not happened. And he's kept the maximum pressure campaign that Trump put in place. Again, how do you reconcile these contradictory positions coming from the Americans?
We also believe that this is a contradictory and double-sided behavior by the U.S. government, and we believe that this is the U.S. administration which should explain about such contradictions in their behavior.
The follow-up that I wanted to ask you is that in terms of sanctions removal, the United States, they have various labels, right? So now they have nuclear-related sanctions, non-nuclear-related sanctions. Is their position still that they're only going to lift the nuclear-related sanctions and everything else stays?
Still on the issue of sanctions and removal of sanctions, the process of serious and real negotiations have not yet started. Of course, several drafts have been exchanged between the two sides. But what is clear and what is significant is that from our point of view, any sanction which is in contradiction and inconsistent with the JCPOA and the nuclear deal should be removed immediately. Either these sanctions have been imposed during Obama or Trump or Biden administrations, all of them should be removed. The same case applies with all the sanctions which are somehow related to the JCPOA, and they also need to be lifted. And on the same basis, all the sanctions which have been imposed under the so-called maximum pressure campaign by the U.S. administration, they need to be removed because they are related to the JCPOA.
Over the weekend, Robert Malley, who's heading the negotiations on the U.S. side, gave an interview to Al Jazeera. He said that
because Iran's nuclear program is so advanced that, quote, time was running out.
As I've said before, this is a technological clock, it's not a chronological clock. In other words, if they slow down their nuclear program, we'd have more time. If they continue at the current pace, then time is running out. Secretary Blinken has made that clear over and over again. Time is running out, and we and the Europeans will have to conclude, if Iran continues on down this path, that they have killed the JCPOA and the JCPOA would be no more.
Germany's new foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, gave a similar comment. Speaking at the G7 in England, she said that, quote, we do not have any progress. Due to the offer of the Iranian government, negotiations have been thrown back 6 months. She also added that time was running out. Now, the consensus among Western countries is that time is running out and Iran needs to do the right thing and come back into compliance. When I spoke last week with Professor Merendi, he told me that it's time for the Americans and Europeans to grasp that time is not on their side. Despite the discomfort, Iran has learned to live with sanctions to manage the maximum pressure campaign against it, and it has more leverage now with its nuclear program than ever before.
As I said, the maximum pressure campaign, despite the hardship, but the economy has sort of, you know, it's adjusted. And Iran is increasingly looking to live with sanctions rather than live in hope of the removal of sanctions. So that I think gradually the sanctions regime will become increasingly less influential.
I asked Dr. Baghri what he thought about Robert Malley's comments and how Iran would potentially scale back its program if, say, the U.S. rejoined the accord tomorrow. He told me that Iran was doing nothing covert, that the program is completely remedial and operating fully within the framework of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and the Safeguards Agreement. He added that once the Americans lift their sanctions, Iran has no problem reversing the remedial measures that it has taken.
The argument from the West, from the Americans, is that Iran is moving too quickly with its nuclear program. I believe Robert Malley, who's a special envoy of the U.S. to Iran, he said that this is not a chronological problem, it's a technological clock that's in place, that basically Iran needs to slow down its nuclear program. How do you plan on, let's say, for example, tomorrow morning the JCPOA is back in place with the Americans, they return. How would Iran basically scale back its nuclear program and get back to where it was before? And what is your response to this idea that Iran is breaching the agreement, even though Iran is still in the JCPOA?
All the nuclear activities of Iran are being undertaken within the framework of the NPT and the Safeguards Agreement. And all the nuclear activities of Iran comprehensively are being inspected by the IAEA authorities. Iran does not have any secret nuclear activities. And the nuclear activities Iran is taking at the moment is exactly compatible with the JCPOA, because paragraphs 26 and 36 of the JCPOA entitles Iran in order to wholly or partially suspend its activities if the other party fails to fulfill its commitments. We have announced earlier and we reiterated that our reactions are remedial, and we started our nuclear activities 1 year after the United States pulled out of the nuclear agreement. When the Americans remove the illegal sanctions against Iran, grounds will be paved for Iran to stop its remedial activities.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
When Trump quit the JCPOA in 2018,
he reimposed sanctions on Iran, targeting its oil and banking sectors, which have taken a heavy toll on Iran's economy and standard of living. Iran has over 1,500 U.S. sanctions on it, more than all other countries combined. One of the Iranians' main concerns right now at the negotiations is trusting that the Americans will actually stay in the deal and abide by it if they rejoin. Iran wants a comprehensive verification method for sanctions relief, a guarantee that whoever succeeds Biden in the Oval Office won't just tear up the accord again and target Iran with what is essentially siege warfare. In 2010, Iran ranked sixth globally in attracting foreign direct investments. When the nuclear deal was reached, many Western and international firms invested billions in Iran, only to see their investments go down the drain when the U.S. left the deal in 2018 and placed sanctions again on the Islamic Republic, making it impossible to interact with Iran without fear of reprisal. You can see here in 2015 how foreign investment in Iran was climbing, and then suddenly a sharp decline in 2019 with the departure of the U.S. and reimposition of sanctions the year before. You can understand the reluctance of foreign firms to go through such a debacle again, given the uncertainty of the Americans and their actions, not to mention how it affects Iranians themselves and their well-being. I asked Dr. Baghdadi why he should trust the United States this time and how he plans on making sure the Americans hold up their end of the deal if they come back to it at all.
So, Dr. Baghdadi, the JCPOA, it has a mechanism to verify with the IAEA that Iran complies with the agreement, with the accord. What's the mechanism to verify that the Americans will comply with whatever agreement is reached, if it's just returning back to the simple JCPOA? How will Iran be able to verify that the Americans are actually lifting the sanctions? How can you make sure that the next American administration in 2025 is not just going to come in and quit the JCPOA again and put sanctions on Iran again?
There are very differences of opinions and different issues in the draft text provided in the 20th of June. The issues you referred to, the issue of guarantees and the issue of verification, are one of those differences which have not yet been resolved, and they should be resolved in the course of negotiations in order to conclude a mutually agreed deal.
So just as a last question, what is the biggest obstacle for the JCPOA to be re-implemented in full by everybody?
I believe that if the other party is enjoying a serious determination and practical preparedness in order to fulfill all its obligations within the framework of the JCPOA without any exception, then I truly believe that within a short span of time, we would be able to reach a mutually agreed deal.
Dr. Baghdadi, thank you so much for your time and for sitting down with us for this interview. I really appreciate it.
I would also to thank you and your viewers.
Thank you.
What's clear in covering these talks is that there's a lot of back and forth, a huge blame game being played. The Americans and Europeans want Iran to scale back its nuclear program before they do anything, but Iran is also unequivocal and wants the Americans to get back in the deal first. Dr. Baghdadi, Iran's chief negotiator, told me that everything Iran is doing is within the framework of the NPT, the Safeguards Agreement, and the JCPOA. When I spoke to him earlier, he invoked Article 26 and 36 of the JCPOA. What is absolutely crystal clear and indisputable is one thing. The JCPOA does say in these two articles that if there is significant non-performance and reimposition of sanctions, Iran will treat this as grounds to cease performing its commitments under the JCPOA in whole or in part. That's not an opinion, it's a fact. That's what it says in the JCPOA. It's crystal clear. Now, once again, this is something we've repeated 1,000 times, but it's true. Iran's remedial measures, whether that's increasing the cascades, its number of centrifuges, or enriching uranium past 3.67%, these are things that are all part of the deal. So the Americans may not like it, the Europeans may not like it, and the Western press may lie about it. But Iran has, in fact, stuck to the deal the entire way through, even when scaling up its nuclear program, because it has the right to do so after the Americans left. Iran never left the deal. So if the Americans and Europeans want Iran to scale back its nuclear program, the U.S. is going to have to re-enter the nuclear accord first. The only reason the other parties are at the negotiating table with Iran in the first place is precisely because Iran has leverage, and they're not giving that up. Why should they, when they're allowed to have it under the JCPOA? Dr. Bhavadi was unequivocal. The ball is now in the Americans' court. Coming to you directly from Vienna, thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight.
Warmer winters are happening across the globe and can be drivers of catastrophic weather events and profound changes. We now present you an article written by Catherine Gammon. The piece is titled, Scientists Say Warmer Winters Can Wreak As Much Havoc As Hotter Summers. As climate scientist Kai Kornhuber walks around New York City this winter, an eerie feeling creeps into his body. It's warm enough for a t-shirt in December, and the birds are chirping loudly. Kornhuber, a postdoctoral researcher at Columbia University's Earth Institute, says the temperatures tell birds and trees that it's time for action, but the systems are out of sync for December. Kornhuber said, It's not right. There's a disconnect between how it should be and how it is. Warmer winters are happening across the globe and leading to some big impacts. 2021 brought the planet's 16th warmest February since records began. While the popular imagination might associate the climate crisis with scorching summers and their attendant droughts, wildfires, hurricanes, and heat waves, milder winters can also be drivers for catastrophic weather events and profound changes. They range from shifts in agricultural use, triggering changing weather patterns, to boosting the likelihood of violent events, like the swarm of tornadoes that wreaked havoc in the American Midwest and South over last days. Daniel Swain, a climate scientist at University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA, studying how extreme events are changing on a warming Earth, says, One of the truisms in climate crisis is that cold places and cold times of year warm faster than the warmer places and warmer times of year. He adds, Not only is the actual rate of warming faster in colder seasons and places like the Arctic, which is warming 3 times faster than other places, but also a lot of impacts that are associated with warming are amplified. Daniel Swain points to one specific threshold where temperature has a huge impact, whether precipitation falls as liquid rain or frozen snow depends on just a single degree of difference. And in the west of America, where there was a gigantic snow drought until just a few days ago, that has huge impacts. Daniel Swain says, There was wildfire risk up until recent days, even at 8,000 to 9,000 feet in elevation, adding, that has directly to do with the lack of snowpack. When precipitation falls as snow, it sticks around for longer, creating runoff moisture for the spring season. It's often referred to as the bank of future water for moisture-strapped places. But when it falls as rain, it runs off immediately. Daniel Swain explains, Winter warming affects the frozenness or not of things which is ecologically important for the accumulation of snowpack and a water supply. Kornhuber says warm spells in winter can create extreme heat waves later on in the summer. Unseasonal warmth can lead to a premature snowmelt and vegetation growth, which lowers soil moisture and amplifies the likelihood of extreme and persistent heat waves throughout the summer. He points to the chain of events that led up to a heat wave that rocked Siberia in 2020 and was associated with wildfires that lasted the whole summer and caused record-breaking carbon emissions. Kornhuber says, in that event, late winter heat in February and March sucked moisture from the soil at a time when vegetation was also taking up moisture, and parched soils can lead to summer heat waves, adding, low soil moisture is one of the most important ingredients of mega heat waves. Chara Lepore, an associate research scientist at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University, says climate model projections for the United States indicate that overall there will be an increase in the likelihood of conditions favorable to severe storms as the planet warms. Chiara Lepore published research recently predicting 14% to 25% increase in severe storms per every extra 1 degree Celsius of future global temperature increase. She says, the main driving mechanism is warming temperatures and increasing moisture, which are some of the major ingredients in storm updrafts, adding, that number represents the increasing frequency of conditions favorable to severe weather occurrence, not actual storms, and only some of these storms will produce tornadoes. She says the uncertainty is still large. Daniel Swain says the climate crisis evidence is weaker for tornadoes than for other huge storms, but that's mainly because it hasn't been studied as much. He says the vertical instability, which is likely with more warming, would create an increase in tornado-producing environments, adding, so it's pretty clear that climate change will begin to increase the likelihood of severe convective weather. Warmer winters can also impact agriculture, as some crops require a threshold of chill hours to achieve optimal outcomes. Cold temperatures that many orchard crops need could decrease by as much as 60% in California's Central Valley by 2100. Researchers say apples, cherries, and pears, which required the longest period of cold weather, could be hit the hardest. Late winter heat can also wreak havoc on crops if they get the biological signal to flourish, only to be knocked down by frost soon after budding. Daniel Swain says it goes to show that relatively small amounts of global warming can have big effects in certain places and certain times of the year. There is even evidence that climate change is at the heart of freak events like the cold snap that left Texas in a deep Arctic freeze last February, causing hundreds of deaths and billions of dollars worth of damage. A weak polar vortex became divided and brought a big gush of cold air to the southern United States, and the vortex is more unstable than in the past. Kornhuber says that winter warming is essentially another form of saying that the summer season extends more and more, while the spring and fall transitions squeeze out what we used to think of as wintertime, adding, as temperatures increase, moderate climate zones just will not have winter the way we know it anymore.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Respected brothers and sisters. Dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You're welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, I'm going to discuss with you an important topic, and that is consulting others or seeking other people's advice. How important is it to seek other people's advice in your life? And actually, what does it mean to consult other people or to seek other people's advice? Well, we are going to use the word consult and seeking advice interchangeably. So to consult means to go to someone such as a doctor or a lawyer or someone with an expert opinion for advice, okay? And it also means to look for information in something such as a book or a map or, let's say, a dictionary. You need to consult in your life. And, of course, consultation is a serious thing. It's a very important decision that you make in your life. For example, when you consult other people, you try to capitalize on other people's advice and opinion as well. So the act of looking for information or consulting other people is highly recommended in Islam. If you give someone advice, you tell them what you think they should do in a particular situation. And if you ask someone to give his advice, you want them to give you his opinion to you in order for you to be able to decide for yourself what to do in a particular situation. So it is important to consult others, isn't it? Of course it is. But some bigoted people do not want to consult others before embarking on an action. They are self-interested, they are opinionated, and they are prejudiced. Let's have a break and we will be back.
Changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh.